You're listening to the Screaming Pods Network.
It's a fantasy adventure. It takes place on sea,
right,
on the sea.
On the sea, yeah.
And it's kind of a combination of, I guess, sort of a Captain's Courageous movie versus The Seventh Voyage of Sinbad.
Wow.
You
yeah.
ever seen that?
No. Do people want that?
Yeah. ask me if I care.
Now, I've seen part of this film, and I think it is absolutely terrific.
Well, thanks. Well, one day, hopefully, you'll see the whole thing.
Yeah.
But, no, a part is good. That's more than I could hope for, I guess.
All right.
I think that's admirable, Dave.
I don't want to jinx this,
really,
but it looks to me like it has Blockbuster stamped all over it.
Oh, well, that's very nice. Yeah.
And people... I think the movie is great.
You know, I know you, and I know you're being sincere.
Yeah. All right, now, Chris, do people seem to enjoy the movie? Because you've
people,
had some...
People, not only, and I'm being very sincere here, I'm very honest with you, they are not only enjoying the film, they are saying it's changing their lives.
Really?
I swear to God. Backstage, I was backstage, and one of your staff members, and I shouldn't do this because I know we're short on time because we got a big show, but... One of your guys said something to me backstage, and I want to, if I can, just break from this and bring him, Biff Henderson.
Biff Henderson,
here.
One of our stage managers, ladies and gentlemen. Biff, how are you?
Thank you, Biff.
Biff, you said something to me backstage that really just, it just devastated me. It floored me, and it meant a lot to me, and I thought maybe you should share it with the folks at home. Look at one of the trees here and talk into it.
Okay. I just want to tell black people everywhere that if they enjoy seeing a goofy white boy act like an idiot for 90 minutes, then this is surely the movie for you to see.
Let's talk about your new movie now, Cabin Boy.
Oh, you're a cupcake for bringing that up.
He is a cupcake, isn't he?
But it seems to me the plot is vaguely familiar, right?
It's familiar. It's somewhat similar to Captain's Courageous, which is an old favorite movie of mine. And it follows the story of a rather obnoxious brat who's graduates from a rich spoiled kid who graduates from a foppish finishing school, and he's sent to Hawaii to take over his father's business, and ends up getting on the wrong boat with a bunch of overweight
ne'er-do-wells.
Yeah, not well, yeah,
foul-mouthed fisherman is what he ends up with.
So, what do they make? They make him a menial.
They say he has to stay with them, and he becomes the cabin boy, and they end up going into this sort of Bermuda Triangle area called Hell's Bucket, and there's all sorts of creatures that they encounter.
But does this build character? Do you end up being a much better person for this experience?
He learns the truth of life.
I love a message from these
fat fishermen.
These guys are that rough, huh?
That's right.
Bet you
sort of like Steve Martin's The Jerk, only worse.
Well, I've been called that many times. So.
Not exactly something Cary Grant would turn down.
No. It's I guess I play kind of a cross between Freddie Bartholomew and Peter Lawford.
Yes.
I think that's the closest.
So I can see that.
Letterman has a cameo in this?
Yeah, Dave has a cameo. There's a lot of cameos. My dad has a cameo in it. Ricky Lake actually plays the figure head of the boat that comes to life. There's Russ Tamblyn, who is in West Side Story, actually plays Chalky, who's a half man, half shark. He's sort of the biological offspring of a relationship I don't want to go into. But.
Now, Chris, I know what a problem it is to sell anything in Hollywood.
Sure.
When you went with the treatment or the premise or whatever it was that you put down on a couple of pages, did you have trouble explaining this?
I can't type, Regis.
You just went in and ad-libbed this to the studio heads?
Well, luckily, we didn't have to go into the guys in the suits. We had to go in and sit with Tim Burton. Because he produced the movie. But it was interesting because we sat, Adam Resnick, who wrote with me on Late Night and created Get a Life with me, we went in and we spoke to Tim, and he sat there stone-faced throughout the whole thing. And
trying
you know,
to visualize.
I started sweating and started, you know, shaking uncontrollably. And then suddenly at the end, he was bouncing off the walls, literally, and taking his sketch pad and drawing what the six-armed woman should look like.
Yes,
and,
you finally got stuff. To him. Yeah. Well, that's the right guy for this kind of
yeah,
a movie.
Yeah, we knew that right away.
And so that's a Disney product, huh?
It's a, yeah, Disney touchdown.
All right, terrific. Okay, good luck with
it.
Okay. You betcha, Chris.
Nice meeting you.
Cabin Boy, opening today all around America. We'll be right back in a moment.
So after Cabin Boy came out and it got panned mm-hmm. sort of universally, and you got nominated for a Razzie Award, and it had its definitely had its audience of boys like me at that age
right.
who like absolutely loved the movie. What was that like for you? That's your first big movie that you're on top of, and
well, my career came to a screeching halt after
really?
Cabin Boy. Yeah, I mean it was, you know, Adam Resnick, who wrote it and directed it, is my good friend, and we've worked together since Letterman. You know, for both of us, it was like a traumatic experience, and I think we were really naive. I don't think we understood that, you know, okay, this movie didn't hit it out of the ballpark, but we'll do another movie, and mm-hmm. that'll be better. That's the way I thought. I had no idea that, you know, if your first movie doesn't work, they don't give you a second chance to do it. So, you know, I was kind of shocked that, well, you're kidding me, just because of that, I can't do another
So you're meeting? Taking meetings after that. You're talking to your agent. What is he telling you? What is he telling you? I'm giving
outlook,
your agent a he-she.
The outlook was grim. And I remember Adam and I went and we pitched a TV show for me after Cabin Boy, and they bought it in the room, which means they loved the idea. And we were out in at the parking lot and out in L.A., and we got calls from our agents. They bought it. They love it. You know, we're doing the pilot. And about 6 hours later, we both got these calls. There was one person who wasn't in the meeting, somebody higher up, and she had said, oh, yeah, I love this idea. That's great. Who are the writers doing it? And they said, Chris Elliott and Adam Resnick. And she said, no, not those guys, not the Cabin Boy guys.
Welcome to another episode of Just the Disc. My name's Brian Sauer. This is a podcast about Blu-rays. I almost lost my train of thought there, but I saved it because I'm a pro? Anyway, I am joined this evening to talk about a beloved comedy by my good friend, John Cribbs. John, thank you for joining me.
Thank you, Brian.
So we are talking about Cabin Boy, which has come out in a very spiffy new special edition Blu-ray from Kino Lorber, and I am really excited about the care that has been taken with this release. I think you said that Heather Buckley was involved with producing the interview, and it's a great interview between Chris Elliott and Adam Resnick. There's a great commentary track with Resnick and Elliott. Anyway, we'll talk about that in a minute, but I just want to say up front, I was impressed with this disc. I hope you were too.
Absolutely. And yeah, exactly. I found out about this release by Heather, you know, putting it up on Twitter that she, you know, had worked on it. It was like, wow, that's like a double, that's like double good news right there. Cabin Boy on Blu-ray, and that she had worked on it. So obviously you're going to get high quality there. And I was not disappointed. It's a beautiful disc and just excellent stuff that you never thought you would get for a movie so despised for so many years.
Yeah. Yeah, let's talk about that. So when was the first time that you saw this movie, and did it get you right away? Because I got to admit that my first viewing was a perplexed one, but I now adore the movie. But I'm curious what you thought.
I ignored this movie for so long because I remember the trailer was ubiquitous when it came out on TV in the beginning of 1994. It just seemed to be everywhere. And the trailer was completely based on the line, "These pipes are clean."
Touchstone Pictures presents...
Here's how a harem girl dances. Okay, well, thank you for that, whatever that was.
Cabin Boy.
They're coming.
It's the story of a boy and his love affair with the sea.
This moron got on the wrong boat.
He never dreamed where the winds of fortune would blow him. Where the spirit of adventure would hurl him. Or where the hands of fate...
Come on over here, honey.
...would grab him.
These pipes are clean!
Touchstone Pictures presents...
What happened to you?
Well, let's just say I've finally shed my feminine side.
Chris Elliott.
So this is what you guys do for fun? Humiliate an imbecile?
Cabin Boy.
Thank you, fellow crewmates. I'm off. And when I return, I shall be a cabin man.
Rated PG-13. Now playing at a theater near you. Check newspaper for showtime.
And so I didn't know the context. I was like, so it's some comedy about a plumber? What's... I don't get it. And my friends and I would make fun of that line. You know, like, yeah, Cabin Boy sounds real good. So I wasn't familiar with Chris Elliott at the time. I just completely thought this looks like the dumbest goddamn thing. And it wasn't until college when my friend Mike Morona got me into Get a Life.
Excuse me, is this seat taken? Actually, it's reserved for a model in training, not for members of the custodial staff.
Oh, my, sounds like someone's drawing battle lines. Well,
let me tell you something, pal. What you're going through right now is called an awkward stage, okay? You'll grow out of it. I was an ugly duckling once, too. Now look at me. I'm a beautiful swan.
Let's get something straight, you little troll. You can sit there, but I don't have time for your inane squawkings. I'm going to graduate head of the class. I'm going to make so much money, I'll be able to buy my own island in the Caribbean.
How exciting. Can I just say one thing?
You're nuts. Stay out of my way. Understand? Because this rocket's headed for the stars, and there isn't enough oxygen up there for the two of us.
I'm sorry, what did you say? You had a butt lift?
How embarrassing.
And I started watching that obsessively, and then it was like, and these guys made a movie called Cabin Boy. Like, what? Cabin Boy? Like the punchline for like every, you know, terrible studio movie? These guys were responsible for that. So, of course, I had to see it right away. And then I loved it immediately.
Yeah, I think my thing was I came around to Get a Life a little later. Like, I remember watching it. And I think it was on before The Simpsons, maybe. But, I liked it, but I didn't love it. And I gotta admit, I don't know that I got it. I don't think I started to get that kind of humor until I got hardcore into The Simpsons in the mid-90s. And then I think it started to make sense to me. You know what I mean? It just seemed like, wait, annoying people are funny? I don't get it. They're just annoying. You know, it was kind of my attitude or at the time. But I've since come to find that annoying people are actually some of my most favorite, most laughed at things. And it's a constant sort of divide between my wife and I, because she really doesn't care for that kind of comedy very much. You know?
Yeah, I can't imagine sitting down with my wife to watch this one. I think it's probably the same sort of deal.
There might be parts of this that would appeal to my wife, but ultimately I think it would just make her annoyed. But yeah, this is such a unique and interesting film because, you know, as they explain in all the special features, and I knew this, that, you know, I saw Tim Burton's name on it. It's produced by him. And so I think there was a part of me that was like, oh yeah, I kind of see how he might want to be a part of this thing. But I never knew that it was originally written for him and pitched to him and something he was going to direct, because he was a big fan of Get a Life, which I didn't know, and he wanted to work with Chris Elliott. And so he and Adam, Chris and Adam, developed this whole idea. They're like, you know, in the interviews that I clipped at the front of the show, Chris is talking about it as Captain Courageous meets Seventh Voyage of Sinbad, which is a really interesting pitch, because especially in 1993 or 94, doesn't seem like that's going to be a big moneymaker. And I didn't even see Captain's Courageous until about 5 or 6 years ago. And I love the movie. I actually think it's a really great movie. But it was so funny to see it in reverse and be like, wait a minute, this is Cabin Boy. But anyway, it's a really neat thing that they did to basically design a Tim Burton movie. He was looking to do something along the lines of a Pee-wee's Big Adventure, which I hadn't really thought about it in that realm, but it is a unique movie in the same kind of way that Pee-wee's Big Adventure is unique, I think.
I agree, yeah. And it's funny, you know, people, fans of the movie say that, well, it's a shame that this movie wasn't popular and that, you know, Elliott and Resnick didn't get to make more movies together. And my response to that is, are you crazy? It's a miracle that this thing exists at all. That two guys with a failed television show found a fan in the hottest filmmaker in Hollywood, Tim Burton, at his most powerful time, like post-Batman, to fund a insane riff on Captain's Courageous that has Ray Harryhausen's stop-motion creatures, a tobacco-spitting cupcake phantom head, and a half-Viking, half-shark character released into theaters? Thank your lucky stars. How did this thing come about? It seems like one in a million possibility that this would get past the development stage.
Yeah, it's
especially once Burton backed out and decided he didn't want to direct the movie. Like, how did it move forward? It's crazy. And I know these guys say a lot of things in the features, you know, about what a miserable experience it was for them having the film tank and get thrashed for so long. But goddamn, what a miracle. Like, what an amazing thing that this film exists.
I agree. And in rewatching it and listening to the features, despite hearing Chris and Adam talk about how damaging it was for them, and I do remember some of that. I do remember it being a joke. I was watching Letterman around that time, and they talk about it in the commentary that he was constantly bringing it up to sort of make fun of himself, but ultimately kind of ends up, you know, kind of bashing the movie unintentionally or seeming to, and that, you know, was too bad. But they were just talking about how it was this phenomenon. It was like a punchline to the joke of a bad movie. Like, what, it was just everywhere, pre-internet, pre-memes, and somehow it was able to get out there, and people were able to, you know, like, the public knew about this flop. It wasn't just an inside Hollywood thing. So it's sad to hear about that stuff, but watching the movie, I just am like you say, I'm so happy that it exists, because it is such a weird confluence of Get a Life and Chris Elliott sensibilities with that, you know, Harryhausen and classic seafaring tale. It's just nuts. It's just a nutty film.
It's absolutely incredible. I mean, it's funny because I guess everyone just sort of dismissed it out of hat, thinking it's just, you know, a vehicle for Chris Elliott. That's just going to be like a lot of dumb sketch stuff. And when you actually see the film, you're not prepared for just like how different it is and how unique it is. And I think, you know, maybe even after experiencing that, some people kind of say, well, it's, you know, it's got this artificial quality to it. It doesn't, you know, it's not well produced. Not getting that that's the point, you know, that it's it's that it's made that way on purpose. And I honestly think about it sometimes, wondering like how it would look if Tim Burton did do it, if it was more like a Pee-wee's Big Adventure sort of thing. And I was just having a conversation with my friend Chris Funderburg, my Pink Smoke co-head, about Tim Burton getting in his own way when it comes to like becoming like a visionary, you know, artist in films. That he's just, I feel like a lot of his movies suffer from him just putting too much into it that points to the artificiality of it. Whereas you have a director like Barry Sonnenfeld, who was also making movies at the time, who knew how to do pop art, but not, you know, emphasize, you know, the art of it, just have it be a fun movie like an Addams Family or a Get Shorty. And I think that in directing this film, even though it was his only film, he wasn't experienced as a director, I think that Adam Resnick does a fantastic job not getting in the way of the movie. And that just makes the movie that much more crazy, that he has a very straightforward, you know, approach to it, that he doesn't go nuts with the special effects or the camera work, that he just kind of lets this stuff play out. And it just kind of gives it even more of a wackiness, I think. Welcome to Wackville, you know, with this movie.
Yeah, I mean, he's got so much to work with in terms of the cast. I mean, Chris Elliott alone is a one-man show and a guy that I could watch in just about anything. But then once he, I mean, for those that don't know, it's basically, it's kind of been said in the opening clips, but it's about this spoiled brat kid who goes to this finishing school and gets done and is on his way to Hawaii to sort of inherit the family business. And his dad is played by his dad, again, like Get a Life. Unfortunately, that the only scene his dad is in is very short. Apparently, there was a little bit more that was cut. But anyway, so he's on his way to Hawaii. He takes the wrong boat, and he ends up with a bunch of foul-mouthed fishermen. But that group of actors is played by some of the great character actors ever. You've got Brian Doyle Murray. You have Brian James. And then you have, oh, damn it, what's his name from Major League?
James Gammon.
James Gammon. who has just one of the greatest voices like ever. I just adore his voice. But anyway, those guys are so good that all you have to do is kind of let them go. And it makes for, and the captain, I forget the actor's name that plays the captain, but he's also very good.
Oh, he's great. He's on Get Life too. And yeah, I always forget it's Rich something. Jeez. Ah, God. Yeah. But he's fantastic. Yeah. I wish he was in more stuff, but I agree with Gammon's
Rich Brinkley.
Voice. Yes.
Rich Brinkley. But yeah. And then Andy Richter is in the movie for a far too short a period and he's great. So, and Dave's got a famous cameo, which I'm obligated to play the clip of.
Watch it. What? Would you? Lady! Ugh. No. Ugh. Oh. Ugh. Oh. Ugh. Oh. Oh. Horrible. Hey. But, off me. Jeez. Where are you going? Stop it! Stop! I've had it with you. Bunch of stinkos in here. You, old man. Look, I am in desperate need of assistance.
Well, what's on your mind, little girl?
I realize that you are most likely the product of lower class inbreeding, but perhaps you could help me.
Oh, gosh, I certainly hope so.
I have been wandering this dreary village in hopes of finding the Queen Catherine. You wouldn't have any idea where she might be docked, would you?
You know what you are? You're one of those little fancy lads, aren't you? Boy, you're cute. Okay. Gosh, what a sweet little outfit. Is it your little spring outfit? No. You couldn't be cuter. You're so adorable. Oh, my. You know, you remind me of my niece Sally. Lovely girl. She's a dietitian. Hey, would you like to buy a monkey?
No, I don't want to buy a monkey.
Are you sure?
No, I'm on my way. Your right. Family must be very proud
all
of
right,
you.
All right, we'll see you, honey. Hey, wait a minute. Jennifer, come here.
What?
Come here. I can show you to that ship of yours.
You will?
Right down this road. Right there.
Marvelous. Well, I probably should hurry, shouldn't I? Because they're going to start the banquet soon. Oh. And I must tell you, I'm famished.
Well, why wouldn't you be? Big girls have big appetites, don't they?
Listen, do yourself a favor. Don't let them give you any of that flank steak bullshit. You know what I'm saying? Try the London broil.
Oh.
Yeah.
Well, that's a good tip.
Sure.
I shall do it.
Pamper yourself.
Well, I will.
Okay.
Oh, my. Yeah. Well, you know, I must tell you, for a yellow-eyed, gamey-smelling lowlife, you really have quite a decent heart about you, sir.
Well,
I'm not going to touch you. I'm not going to shake your hand or get near you because you're all of that.
Yeah.
But I am going to be on my way.
Okay, good for you.
Yep, off I go.
Yeah. Hey, listen, have a good trip, okay. Susie. Bye-bye.
Bye.
Think about me, all right? Oh, man, do I hate them fancy lads.
But, yeah, there's just a lot of great people making this material work, and it just speaks to the talent in my head and vision that Chris Elliott and Adam Resnick have as far as comedy, because this is, as Adam says multiple times in multiple interviews and the commentary, this is not even a project they wanted to do. Like, it was not the picture that they would have chosen to make had they been given carte blanche to make it.
The other thing to add to the mix that sort of made it a little wonky is, you know, it was written for Tim Burton. Like, if I was set, right. If I set out and wanted to write a movie, you know, for Chris or for just if I was going to write a screenplay, something like Cabin Boy would have been the last thing I would have come up with, you know. Right. It was right. So, it just, I think I thought, you know, I didn't want to do it at first, you know, when Tim finally said, you know, you should do it. This is you and Chris. This is more your thing. And he decided, you know, he wanted to do something else. And, you know, which was nice of Tim to offer that opportunity. But it was but my original instinct was I've never directed anything before other than, you know, a little bit of tiny little remotes or something on Letterman or pieces like that. And plus I was thinking, well, this isn't something that I don't know that I have this burning passion for, you know, to do. But then enough people convince you that, you know, this is shot like this comes along once in a lifetime and just do it. And plus after that, you write your own ticket and write whatever kind of movie you want. But never, that's a lesson of that one. Never do anything just for the opportunity or to assume, oh, it's not necessarily what I would do, but it will lead to something more and better things afterwards. That was a mistake, but I don't blame myself because I was just, you know, stupid and younger and didn't understand the bit. That's the other thing, coming from Letterman, we were insulated and protected day. It was very anti-Hollywood show business. No people had aspirations, you know, but it was so almost like Dave didn't say it this way. It was almost implied, but it was almost like, you know, be careful. We go after that Hollywood because those people, you know, that's a bad play. But that cliche in a way, I think, you know, maybe it's a self-fulfilling prophecy.
So it's such a weird thing to have all these elements. You know, I mean, Tim Burton's success really leads to some very interesting films that don't get a lot of studio interference because he was so successful at a certain point. We get Ed Wood, Almost Untouched, which is amazing. And then we get this, which would never, ever get through a studio without some crazy successful director kind of putting, you know, his golden touch on it and just saying, go ahead, let his Jedi mind, like, let it through. It's fine.
It's a miracle, man. I'm telling you, it's unbelievable that this thing got through. I mean, I can't, you know, praise Adam Resnick highly enough. I'm a huge fan. If anyone has not read his book, Will Not Attend, highly recommend. It's one of the funniest books I've ever read. But just to give everyone an idea of like what mentality we're dealing with going into this movie, he did an interview on a great book called Poking a Dead Frog with Mike Sachs, who does the who moderates the commentary on this disc. And in that, he mentions that he was so high on people loving his script for Cabin Boy and Tim Burton, you know, praising it to the skies, that he immediately started writing a script that would be his directorial debut, which he imagined as a 1950s period drama about an incestuous brother and sister that takes place down south on a worm farm.
Wow.
So that was his, that's the mentality we're talking about. You know, that was his dream project.
Wow.
If Cabin Boy had been a hit, his screenplay for Cabin Boy had come out and Tim Burton directed and it was a hit, the Worm Farm script was going to be next.
Damn.
They bring it up and say, what happened to that? And he says, well, I don't know. Darren Aronofsky read it recently.
Whoa.
And the guy's, and Mike Sachs is like, oh, is he going to direct it? He's like, no, of course not. Of course he's not going to direct it.
Wow. Yeah. No, Resnick is like, he reminds me a little bit of Terry Zwigoff, both in the way that he sounds and in the way that he is a very intelligent guy who is a bit cynical and self-deprecating. And he's even more self-deprecating than Zwigoff is. Zwigoff's a little more confident, but they remind me a lot of each other. And I like that because I like Zwigoff quite a bit. And so just hearing Adam talk through these features, I'm like, I really like this dude. And then I went, you mentioned the book before we recorded, and I found a little clip of him reading a section of it about about his dad and about his dad calling him on the phone to tell him about this new serial that they had gotten, and then proceeding to like get into almost a screaming argument with his mom over the fact that he couldn't remember the name of the serial, and she's in the other room and she can't hear him. So they're getting in a fight with, while Adam's on the phone, and then he finally gets the cereal name and he's like, oh, it's Shredded Mini Wheats. It's just insane. I'm like, I got to read this book. That is an amazing bit because that's just like straight out of his life. So I'm like, okay, I see kind of where he's coming from at some level. And that's remarkable. So,
oh, his dad is such a great character in the book. It's a funny thing that connects him and Chris Elliott, that, you know, well, Chris Elliott's dad, you know, Bob Elliott is a comedy legend, but then, Adam Resnick turns his dad into this amazing comedy character. He tells a story about how he would always never had enough napkins at the table. He always needed more and more napkins, and he would yell at Adam's mom saying, give me more napkins. And during one of these incidents where he had like four or five napkins in front of him, but told her it wasn't enough, he looked over at Adam and said, I think your mom was a napkin in her previous life. meaning that she knew what it was like to get, you know, rubbed on a face and then wadded up and thrown in the trash. That's why she was stingy with the napkins. So.
She had some weird napkin sympathies. Oh, my God.
So
that's brilliant.
Yeah.
See, yeah, this comic universe that we're talking about is a place I love to just hang out in. So that's, I'm picking up that book and I got to read it. But yeah, this movie is so incredibly quotable that the minute you and I decided we were doing the episode and the night I started rewatching stuff, we just started, and I don't do this a lot because, you know, it's just kind of silly sometimes, but there's some movies I just can't help it. So we just started tweeting lines back and forth, you know, because there's so many good lines. You know, I think my favorite is still got to be...
I'm sorry, sir. I was just pondering what drifter's corpse you stole those shoes from.
That he says to his headmaster at the beginning. I just, that to me is such a brilliant layered, you know, insult. It's like, your shoes are terrible. You stole them. You stole them from a drifter, but not a live drifter, a dead drifter. I'm just like, that is so brilliant, you know? Anyway.
That's like updating slapstick to the 90s, you know? I mean, that's just a great crossing over of like comedy mentalities there. I love, yeah. I mean, I love a ton of them. The one that always I immediately think of is, we're just here to catch fish and stink. That's what the sailors. And I also just love Andy Richter walking down the steps of the ship saying, step, 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 step.
Oh, man, I could go on and on. Even stupid random things like Brian James saying,
purple lightning, that's always a good sign.
I mean, just stupid stuff like that. Anyway, it's got tons of lines like that, and I find that some of my favorite cult comedies are those incredibly quotable movies, and Chris Elliott has this remarkable ability to be super obnoxious and annoying and say awful things, but be so oblivious as to be hilarious. And that's, you know, one of the big keys to Get a Life's comedy is that, and he just brings it right into this. He's just got this incredible sensibility about him.
Yeah, or make nonsensical lines funny, like when he's in the classroom and he's making fun of the person who's, you know, doing a presentation, and as he's sitting down, says, somebody's daddy's missing a leg.
Somebody's daddy's missing a leg!
You're like, what does that mean?
I've never been able to figure out that joke, but it's always funny. Because he says that he also likes to speak in a super high voice. And he also likes to speak, apparently, in the voice of his mother. There's a great bit where he's chopping a fish head off. And he just is, like, totally grossed out and put off.
That's it. The head came off. What's inside stinks, and that's all I'm doing.
His reactions to things and being disgusted is also really entertaining. But in that particular moment, apparently he's channeling his mother. So that's another thing that he does. Anyway, Elliot's amazing, but the whole cast is great. And obviously, the writing is just them. It's what they do. It's their sensibility. It's what they think is funny. So it's one of those things where you get it or you don't. And like I said, the first time I saw it, I was like not fully understanding and on board with that annoying people kind of comedy style. And so I didn't like love it. But since I've come around in such a big way, and I was so excited when Get a Life came out on DVD, I had actually bought it on bootleg DVDs off, I don't know, iOffer, eBay or something, and shown my son when he was very young, and we just got so into it. We went through the whole series, and then it came out on DVD officially before we had actually finished going through my bootlegs, so we just sort of finished off that way. But it's still one of my favorite shows of the 90s and still makes me laugh all the time. And I really got to show it to Raven now that I'm thinking about it.
Yeah, I know. And like not seeing it while it was on the air, you know, seeing it some 3 or 4 years after the fact, I just had to watch it. Like, what did people think of this at the time when this was on? You know, it's just so ahead of its time. But we can't move past the cast, though, before mentioning one of the things that makes this movie special. It's close to the end of the film, but it's the appearance of Mike Starr.
Which one of you scumbags diddled my wife?
Oh, yeah. At we should talk about Melora Walters, too.
Yes.
But Mike Starr is great. One of the great bits in the movie is this whole thing where they are in this area called Hell's Bucket, and there's this cave with this woman with multiple arms. I forget what she's called.
She's called Callie. She's played by Anna Magnuson.
Yes. And so she apparently is the kind of woman that you can go to and she will have sex with you because apparently she likes that.
She turns you into a cabin man is what she does.
Yes, she turns you into a cabin man. The downside is she's married to a giant who is also an insurance salesman played by the great Mike Starr, who is also in Ed Wood, by the way, and has a great exchange with Johnny Depp about the Christine Jorgensen story, if I recall.
Look, 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 when I said that you could have the Western territories, I didn't mean all 11 states. I meant California, Oregon and what's that one on top of Washington? Yeah, yeah. Oh, really? Well, screw you!
Hi, can I help you?
Yes, I'm Ed Wood. I'm here about directing the Christine Jorgensen picture.
Well, a couple of things have changed. It ain't gonna be the Christine Jorgensen story no more. Goddamn Variety had to print the story before I got the rights. Now that bitch is asking for the sky.
Ah, you're not gonna make the movie.
No, of course I'm gonna make the picture. I already pre-sold Alabama and Oklahoma. Those were pressed okers. They go for that twisted, perverted stuff. You just do it without the shemale. We'll fictionalize it.
Is there a script?
Fuck no. But there's a poster. It opens in 9 weeks in Tulsa.
Check it out. 1994. I hadn't realized this was the year of Mike Starr. He's in eight movies.
Whoa.
Eight movies, and three of them, I think, are probably his best-known appearances other than, you know, being a corpse in the garbage dumpster in Goodfellas. We got Cabin Boy. We got Hudsucker Proxy, which is another, you know, huge bomb in 1994 that's actually a masterpiece.
Love it.
We got On Deadly Ground, the famous cupcake scene where he gets beaten up by Steven Seagal. We got Blown Away, Baby's Day Out, Trial by Jury, Ed Wood, and Dumb and Dumber are all 1994. It's all Mike Starr right there.
Wow, the year of Mike Starr. I love it.
It was.
Yeah, he is incredible.
Yeah, he's great. But Animagus is also very funny. And you, as you were saying, Melora Walters, who beyond Paul Thomas Anderson, I really don't think I've seen anything with her in it. So she seems kind of like an underappreciated actor as well.
Very much, very much. And she is the perfect romantic foil to Chris Elliott, you know, the kind of person who is just immediately so annoyed with him, and their introduction is basically him getting punched in the face by her.
I've been in that diary for 15 years, you ape!
And her annoyance is palpable the whole time, and it's crazy. Like, he'll do things like, there's one moment that I love where he's like shunned the other fisherman away, and he's like talking, sort of like having a moment with her. He's giving her kind of a shoulder massage, and she keeps sort of shrugging it off. And then he puts like a hand on her shoulder, and she shrugs that off. And then he just puts like one finger on her shoulder as if to be like, I'm still touching you. we still have this connection. It's just such a great moment that I always loved. But she's just a great tonal fit for this part. Like, she just nails it, you know, for this weird universe, this woman who's trying to swim across the ocean for a world record, and she accidentally runs afoul of this group of fishermen.
Swimming from Maryland to Maryland, yeah. It's great. It's like, yeah. It's like she's the kind of mold of the old, you know, tough, you know, slapstick female lead. And again, it's another sort of Resnick and Elliott thing, bringing, you know, something from old Hollywood into like a 90s sort of mentality. So, yeah, you're right. It fits in perfectly with this.
And speaking of old Hollywood, you've got Mr. Russ Tamblyn playing Chalky, the half man, half shark, who takes a liking to Chris Elliott and starts to become sort of his guardian when he's being mistreated by the fisherman. Chalky shows up and is in some way trying to help him out, but he doesn't speak. So it's just a very strange but incredibly memorable detail about this movie that I love.
Oh my God. One of my favorite extras is just the 8-roll footage that has Russ Tamblyn in his jeans shirtless wrestling the giant mulligan puppet, you know, just like holed up in his arms, just beating the hell out of it. It just seems so game. You know, they talk in the commentary about what a great guy he is. And you can tell he just definitely seemed like he showed up and just did whatever weird stuff they told him to do. So very memorable performance.
Yeah, I love just even in the vintage interviews, we're kind of getting into the extras a little bit here. They go through the whole cast and it's great, but then the last one is Russ Tamblyn and he's like, yeah, I'm a half man, half shark. He's just like totally just going with it, you know? It's really funny to see him promoting the movie and his part in that way and not laughing his ass off about it, kind of being like, I get that it's funny, but being like, yeah, this is what I'm doing and I'm happy about it. It's great.
And I guess what he told Adam was, I was in West Side Story where I played a jet. Now I'm a shark.
Yes.
Very nice.
Awesome. Awesome bit. So we should start talking about these extras here. So we've got, let's start with the interview So there's a new interview with Chris Elliott and Adam Resnick, and I want to say it is about 46 minutes long, and it's just the two of them talking, and I loved it. I mean, I loved it from things like, what didn't they have a story about some photo that they saw in the Jaws log that they remembered, like a specific photo from the Jaws log that was something that they sort of bonded over, Chris and Adam did?
Yeah, what did they call it? Like falling popcorn or something like that? It was like a photo that was labeled something very strange. Yeah. There's a crew member falling off a deck like into the water, and it said something like falling popcorn. And they were like, what does that mean?
I just love that they both remembered this specific picture from the Jaws log, which is a great book about, you know, the making of Jaws, and that was something that they bonded over. And it's also sort of shows off their weird sense of humor.
Yeah, that's an awesome thing to bond over. Obviously, that's just a classic, you know, behind the scenes book.
What are some of your highlights from the interview that you remember here?
I like that Alfred Molina didn't apparently know what root beer was.
Or necessarily what part he was playing in the movie, according to them.
That was surprising, although it explains Molina's surliness as he's sitting at the table there.
For sure. And it helps the movie because he plays a brief role as a teacher who is like putting up with Nathaniel, a.k.a. Chris Elliott's, you know, obnoxious shit. And he's very good. But yeah, Elliot lets on that like there was a point when he was getting into makeup or costumes, and he seemed to indicate that he thought he was playing another character, a bigger role. The headmaster, I think, actually. And it turned out he's just this teacher, which is a bit of a smaller role. Anyway.
Just a bit, though. I mean, the headmaster's only got two scenes himself.
Yeah, I mean, he loses out on getting insulted twice. Actually, two of the best insults in the movie. What's the other one? Get yourself a spritzer?
Yes.
I can't. Anyway, so what else? I'm trying to think. I had a couple other notes. I just liked to hear them talk about how the movie got made, how they designed it for Tim, how he dropped out. It's such a weird situation to have happen, and you can see why movies like this almost never get made, because it requires an incredible number of things to happen, coincidences and just twists of fate that allow this to get through. So it's fascinating to hear all the things involved with it getting made, and then to hear them start talking about how much it hurt when it failed and how damaging it was both personally and professionally, especially to Adam Resnick. I found a couple clips of him talking about specific self-esteem damage, basically, that this movie had.
What I'll never understand, though, is, and Chris will never understand, is why it was so reviled, why it was such a, you know, that to me is supernatural. That cannot be explained so easily. But it fucked me up for life. If I've never been the same person. I've been, you know, when I was growing up, we always had lots of dogs, and we had this, a German Shepherd that I really loved that, you know, he's a great dog, but one of the neighbors, you know, it was a rural area. I guess he came on his land and he shot the dog. Didn't kill him, though. My dad, I thought, was going to kill the guy. I mean, the guy, my dad was like, you know, that just back in those days, it was scary. He easily could end up in jail. But anyway, but the dog was never the same. The dog, which was very, you know, great looking German Shepherd, good conformation, you know, and after the dog was shot, not that it was shot in the head, it was shot, I know where he was shot, sort of like in the back leg and somewhere else, but he was never the same. His ears were always down. He's a very shy dog after that. I always think of that was sort of me after Cabin Boy. I've never been the same. I've always been, I'm more uncertain, more worrisome, much less confident person. Not that I had much confidence to begin with. And I think Chris as well would say this for, you know, a few years afterwards. I believed exactly that it was just a complete worthless piece of shit, and it's not that's a little bit above that. I'm not saying it's way above that, but it is sort of just an unusual sort of movie that I feel okay about now. But I was very, you know, humiliated, embarrassed, you know, and that's the thing, embarrassed, because I'm kind of a whatever. I don't like a lot of things. I'm like snobby about stuff. So to be considered a hack, you know, was. And to the point that, you know, I'm thinking, wow, I can't even have a conversation with someone and give an opinion on anything anymore. I'm like, you know, that movie, for whatever reason, was just seen as that's what I don't get. So you can say what you want about Cabin Boy. I wouldn't call it hacky. But I think that at the time it was seen as below a Pauly Shore movie.
He seems to have recovered somewhat, and the cult of the movie that has developed is, I think, something of a consolation to him, but I don't think it can really make up for the fact that the damage is already done and that they really felt it hard.
Yeah, I really want to get into this. Let me just take 1 second to step aside and just make sure everyone is on the same page with just what a big failure this movie was. It came out the first weekend of 1994. The only other movie debuting that weekend was The Air Up There, the Kevin Bacon basketball movie, which opened fifth. Okay, it made four times as much as Cabin Boy did. Cabin Boy opened at number 13. Under Oliver Stone's Heaven and Earth, which was in its third week, and just barely edged out Jurassic Park in its 31st week. So
wow,
that gives you an idea. Oh, and in the interview with Mike Sachs from the book, Mike Sachs loves to bring up one of the infamous reviews of the movie from the Fresno Bee, of all places. And the article was titled, "Who Gave These Morons a Camera?"
Oh, boy.
So that was the kind of thing they got. But I think what's really great about this release, about this Blu-ray, is that it doesn't shy away from this aspect of the film, that, you know, it doesn't sugarcoat it at all, that we get to see Adam and Chris talk about how damaging it was to their careers and how depressing it was coming off of this film and just having people thrash it constantly. They even say, you know, David Letterman kind of bolstered the film by making fun of it on the show. He would bring it up and show his cameo in it and everything and make it a joke, but he was still kind of talking about it lovingly at the same time. But I think you hear all these stories about filmmakers who make their first movie and then halfway through the film they realize, I don't like directing. You know, it's just not something I want to do. Resnick falls in with like that kind of mentality, and I think he honestly thinks that he did a horrible job with this film. And the commentary backs it up, where he's just constantly criticizing himself and thinking how much better it would have been if Tim Burton had directed it. I think he's so hard on himself. But again, it's interesting to see something form out of that kind of misery and that kind of mentality. It's hard to listen to. It's hard to – you feel for Adam and you want to tell him, no, man, that's good. It makes sense that the backdrop is so close to the boat. You know, like that stuff looks cool. It's part of what I love about this movie. It just reminds me of the end of Alexander Dovzhenko's biography. The last sentence of his book is something like, filmmaking for me has been a constant misery and I regret everything. It's, to paraphrase it, it's something really depressing, like, oh man. But you really appreciate like the tooth and nails that goes into these kind of things, and you know that that Adam Resnick suffered for our sins, you know, that not only career-wise, but just the hardships that he had to go through in getting this film out there and then having to be the whipping boy for all the horrible Fresno Bee reporters, you know, who went to attack him.
Yeah, no, it's rough. And he is very critical, and that is a bummer because he'll never be able to be objective about it, obviously, for so many reasons. But there is something about the cheesiness of some of the backdrops and the sets and things like that that really add to the charm of the movie overall. And I feel like if it was done on a bigger scale, I don't know that it would be quite as charming for some reason.
Maybe it's just me. I think the movie looks beautiful. I love the sea stuff.
I do too.
They
were talking about a couple specific shots where you can see the seam in the backdrop, and I'm like, okay, yeah, no, I see it, but I don't know. I'm in the movie, you know. You guys have created this crazy world. And if the background doesn't look real, it almost becomes surreal along with everything that's in this movie, and it doesn't even affect me in any way. But they were saying something about how they had written the script, and it was originally like 150 pages, and if Tim Burton had done it, he would have had like five times the money that they had to make it, and that they never sort of adjusted the script based on the huge reduction in budget. So they were just kind of, you know, forced to make do. And I don't know, I think they did a good job. I think, you know, there's a lot of, like I said, charm to the effects and the sets and the costumes and all the things rolled together, including a weird anachronistic timeline where, like, you know, it seems to be taking place in the past, but it's kind of present day too. And I don't know. I don't mind that. I don't need that explained. But all that rolled into the sets and all the production design stuff makes for, again, this incredibly unique film that is really, without question, not like any other film I've ever seen.
Oh, the anachronisms are hilarious when you see the microwave in the background where he takes the bucket of soap water and dumps it into like a modern day mop bucket. Just transfers it from like an old bucket into a new one.
Well, and from the very beginning, you're like, oh, this is some kind of old timey finishing school. And then Chris Elliott gets picked up in a modern limousine. So you're like, okay, no, this is present day, I guess. But everybody's acting like it's not.
Even the light dimmer that she uses when they're about to get it on. When he's about to get it on with the
that's right.
Six-armed woman. It's just like, just putting like, just throws that little extra joke in there. You know?
So much good stuff. And the Harryhausen effects are great too. I mean, not to get too sidetracked, but we were talking about the Mike Starr stuff, and just there's a giant fight between Chris Elliott and Mike Starr, the giant. And so you've got the great, like, what looks like plaster hand holding Chris Elliott. And then Chris Elliott stabbing at around Mike Starr's pocket protector, which is huge, you know, because he's a giant. Just little things like that I just think are so neat.
Oh, yeah. And the scene with the stop motion ice monsters.
Oh,
fantastic,
so
too. It looks great.
I love it.
And that's exactly the thing where they're talking about Tim Burton, you know, getting a bigger budget. And it's like, that's just the thing again about, you know, just getting too tripped up on your artiness. You know, this, it would be a completely different movie if it had a, you know, $20-30 million budget. This, you know, the charm of the film is in its, you know, I don't want to say it's a low budget, but it's in its resourcefulness, you know.
And it, exactly.
And that, you know, constantly throughout the commentary, Adam is complaining that, but the boat's not moving. It should be moving. It should be more realistic. And it's like, no, it's that soundstage quality of it that's so interesting about it. You know, we can see plenty of movies where the boat looks like it's moving. We can see, you know, any number of Pirates of the Caribbean films where they do a good job making the boat look like it's actually out, you know, in the middle of the ocean. But that's not what this film is. And I think, you know, that's the kind of thing where it's fascinating to hear him complain about that stuff. Like, clearly that's the charm of the movie, and that's why you're great.
Yeah. No, it reminds me of the sort of aesthetic in some ways of Get a Life. You know, it's this weird sitcom universe, and the comedy that plays best from Chris Elliott comes in that environment. Like, I'm just trying to think about Chris Elliott, like, in Master and Commander, you know, and yeah, it's great, the whole idea of the scale and everything, but I feel like that detracts from the comedy somehow. It doesn't allow it to play to its proper fullest in some way, and I can't explain why that is, because I don't want to make it sound like they can only do comedy like this, but because I've seen it in these scenarios a couple times, I really do find that it works somehow with their style of comedy. I don't know.
Oh, I absolutely agree, and it's funny to hear, again, to hear Resnick criticize these things, because he also talks about how executives on Get a Life would say, well, it doesn't make sense that he's a 30-year-old paperboy. It's like that's the joke, that's the concept of that's where Chris Elliott, this is Chris Elliott you hired to make a show, you know. So
yeah, have you seen his stuff on Letterman? Come on, it's like, that works perfectly for what he's been doing, you know. Yeah, I went down a little bit of a rabbit hole looking for clips today of Chris Elliott on, you know, talk shows around the time that this came out, and then of course I ran into some of his best stuff for Letterman, where he's like doing, you know, dog food taste tests and, you know, vegetable oil taste tests and just crazy, silly stunts that he is just so perfect at. But he's also really good at deadpan delivery. I mean, he's just such an incredible comedic actor, and I really, really love him so much. But yeah, he, of the two of them, I feel like he is a little bit, they both seem to have a good sense of humor about it while still, you know, not pulling any punches about how rough it was for them. But they're very funny people, so the way that they relay the stories, they're able to find some of the worst possible things but recount them in such a way that you get that they have done what they do. You know, they found the comedy in this horrible thing, and so hearing them talk about it is cathartic in some ways for them, I would think, but also very funny.
It is. And I think, you know, it definitely speaks to both of their characters that they're able to make light of the situation like this, and that they're so self-deprecating that, as just part of their natural character and their natural humor. So, I mean, that's fine too.
What about the commentary? Did you get some other stuff out of that?
Absolutely, I did. In the interview, I'll just say too, I love where they said of the criticism, the last shot was almost too beautiful, that the music was too melancholy, that it ruined the final laugh. Something I never would have thought. I'm also really glad that Bill Murray did not play Mulligan. You know, I think that would have distracted. I think Mike Starr was a perfect casting for that.
Absolutely. No, I would. I mean, it's a neat idea to hear that Bill Murray might have played that role, but I don't think it's as funny. I think Mike Starr's temperament and his physical build is perfect for the giant role. And I think Bill Murray, yeah, like you say, distracting, you know, too wouldn't have been as cool.
Yeah, yeah. My favorite part of the commentary was where Merv, Adam's dad, comes in to play in an anecdote about boasting to everybody that his son was making a movie in Harrisburg, you know, and saying,
"Oh God,
Spielberg don't got shit on him."
I felt so bad for Adam and having to go back to his hometown and have everybody know about it because his dad was so, I mean, as a dad should be, very excited and proud of his son and what he was doing, I guess, but going way, way too far and in Adam's mind, on some level, jinxing the movie.
Yeah, and apparently the Harrisburg paper panned the movie really badly, so.
Oh, Jesus. That's rough, man.
Can't imagine.
I just loved sitting and watch, because it's a very screen-specific commentary, so they're really literally just commenting on different stuff, you know, like, you know, they're watching Andy Richter and they're just like, why the fuck did we kill him off? They're just like loving how good, and he's great in every scene he's in. He's fantastic. And it is a good question. You probably should have kept him around longer. You know, his departure from the film is pretty ridiculous and funny.
Good afternoon, madam. Would you like to buy a donkey? Donkeys are on sale today through Thursday. And be sure to visit our linen department for spectacular savings on stereophonic pumpkins and glow-in-the-dark bowling balls.
Hey, man. Pull yourself together.
Kenny! What are you doing here?
I just wanted to stop by and say, hang in there. You're doing a hell of a job.
Very kind of you, Kenny.
Well, keep up the good work. Bonsoir.
He's going down into the water.
But, yeah, just them sort of noticing different things about it. I love they had an anecdote about how Brian Doyle Murray was always trying to get out of scenes. I think partially because they had a couple really bad rain, at least one really bad rain scene. And then I think he just started trying to say things like, I think my character would be like down below. And then they said he came up with some subplot where he had, or some character trait where he had stomach problems, so he would always be down below. And they eventually started calling him out on it. They're like, dude, you're just trying to get out of scenes.
Just trying to get out of the movie, being as little as possible.
I thought that was really funny.
Also a little upsetting, just because his character on Get a Life is like slacker life goal for me. He's like one of my slacker life goal heroes. And I like to think he's down with those guys.
I love him in Get a Life. Obviously, these pipes are clean. Chris said he gets people saying that to him on the streets all the time, which has got to be a little weird, but very cool.
I feel like, though, have those people seen the movie? Because that thing was all around the trailers. I feel like if the only thing you know from this movie is these pipes are clean, maybe you haven't even seen the movie.
You know? Yeah, no, it could be that you might not have. It's crazy it was featured so prominently, because it's just a weird thing for the marketing people to latch on to.
It seems like a real fan would walk up to him and say, "There, by the grace of God, floats my manhood."
Or what does he say, something about Father, I'll be with you in a saint's whisper or something? I love a saint's whisper. But there is a bit where they keep making jokes about the grips pissing in the water in the water tank, and how Melora Walters swimming in it was like she's a real trooper. I just kept imagining the grips pissing in the water. I was just like, why would they, didn't they have a toilets nearby? But apparently they just made it sound like the Grips were eating in the tank and spilling food and peeing in the water. So it was really gross.
Jesus, I just imagine that in every set, like the set of Titanic, you know, I can't imagine how unhygienic it must have been being an extra in that film. No thanks. Yeah. Not worth the 50 bucks in a day, you know?
Yeah. But anyway, it's a really fun, you know, hour and a half to just hang out with them and listen to them talk about different things. And, you know, even something as simple as Chris Elliott saying, oh yeah, I really did that fall. That really hurt, you know, like remembering getting hurt is really neat. I just like these guys a lot. I just really like hanging out with them. So, despite the fact that you're getting a lot of the sort of bittersweet remembrances, and it could, you know, taint your view of the movie a little bit because, you know, you can genuinely feel the anguish from them through the comedy. But for me, it ultimately makes it a richer, more beloved film in a lot of ways, you know, that they went through so much and were so hurt by its failure. I don't know. It makes me love the movie more for some reason, you know.
Yeah.
There was some true sacrifice, you know.
Absolutely. That's what I meant when I said, like, you know, they kind of died for our sins, because you need that, you know, you need that kind of sad story behind. And it's not even an hour and a half. It's an 80-minute movie. You know, it's like a really short film that you could watch the film and then throw in the commentary and still, you know, have it be the same night.
Yeah, it is lean and mean.
Very lean film. But very enjoyable commentary. It's interesting that Kurt Cobain was a fan of the movie, apparently.
So. Nice. I love it. Kurt Cobain, a fan of Over the Edge and Cabin Boy. I like this
And guy. Weird Al. He had great taste.
Oh, yeah. What a cool guy, man. So sad. So sad.
Yeah.
What else, any other extras? Now I didn't get a chance to read the booklet has an interview from our guy, Nick Pinkerton. Did you get a chance to look at that?
Nick, he's all over the place, isn't he? Doing Modern Romance, commentary. And then, this is a really good, essay, although he claims he saw it opening day with his dad and immediately loved it. I find this very suspicious only because number 13 at the box office. I don't know who was there opening day, but fine. That's fine. He interestingly equates the introduction of Nathaniel, Chris Elliott's character, to the introduction of Christian Bale's character from Empire of the Sun, how he's this kind of spoiled, you know, a kid at a private school, you know, and then he has to kind of, he goes on an adventure, you know, suffers, you know, and by the end of the movie is supposedly, you know, found some kind of insight. But of course, Cabin Boy is a parody of that sort of a plot, but it's a great addition to the whole package. So yeah, Pinkerton's got good taste for sure.
Yeah, man, he's all over stuff we love. I like it. So I talked about the archival cast interviews. Included in that are Chris Elliott, Rich Brinkley, James Gammon, Brian Doyle Murray, Brian James, who's very thoughtful in his interview and taking it seriously. Like, you can just tell he's being funny, but he's like one of the more experienced actors, I think, in the group. And although he often plays smaller parts, it feels like he's a guy who's been doing press or on some level is experienced with this kind of thing. And he just seems like a real pro, which I thought was kind of funny because I always think of him as kind of a sloppy character, a sloppy dude in a lot of roles.
Oh, Brian James is the man. I've been on productions where we identify like the most game actor, the most on board guy, coolest guy as the Brian James, you know, like he gets the Brian James award.
That's awesome.
I love how James Gammon compares the movie to Candide. That's like, wow.
I missed that.
You came on with the right mentality for sure.
That's
you
awesome.
Fit right in.
Yeah, so they talked to Melora Walters and, like I said, Russ Tamblyn. There are audition tapes of Melora Walters and Andy Richter. Very cool stuff. B-roll footage, outtakes. I like the new artwork that they did for the slipcase and for the cover. I don't know how you feel about it.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's very cool that they didn't just go with the Chris Elliott sitting on an anchor, you know, image that we're all used to. Very nice art. Yeah. Who did it? I don't even know who the artist is.
Jacob Phillips, it says here. I don't know him, but good stuff. So do you have any other thoughts on the disc itself or the movie? What have we left off?
Just the TV spots, which, you know, just prove that I wasn't crazy, that every single one used the same two quotes, and the shot of Chris Elliott getting hit by the hook, which I think in the commentary they identify as got a big laugh in the trailer, no laughs in the movie itself.
So sad.
And it does feel a little forced for this movie to have this, you know, kind of pratfall come out of nowhere. So I'm with them on that.
True.
But again, I'm glad that my memory was correct. The edited outtakes are really just one scene. It's an earthworm scene. He finds an earthworm while he's climbing up the hill, and then some boulders fall on him. It's kind of take after take of that. So I know you've said in your show before that you you're not a big fan of outtakes, you know, because they got cut for a reason. But I am kind of curious what the Andy Richter stuff is that they were lamenting having to cut out when he's appears to Chris Elliott in the sky, and they said that was a much longer scene and it was hilarious, but they had to cut it because it was already 80 minutes. We got to cut something.
Yeah, they were just getting pummeled by the studio at that point, I think, because it was testing poorly, or it sounds like. I think that's what they were saying. The other thing I almost forgot to mention is one thing that comes up a couple times as far as them kind of examining why maybe the movie didn't connect was that apparently Ace Ventura was like the big hit comedy around this time, and so that's what people were looking for. They were looking for something like that, and this movie is much more challenging in its approach. And so I think that's one of the things that they were perplexed by, was that, yeah, sure, okay, you didn't like it, but people were angry about it. And that's part of the reason it became, I think, this punchline, is because people, when they get angry about a movie that's challenging them that they don't get, I think there's very much this, like, that is the worst thing ever because I didn't get it. And so I think that's part of it. And they were also mentioned a couple times that apparently Biodome came out right around this time, and for some reason that movie got a pass too. So they're just kind of like, what's going on here? Like, why, you know? But I think it is just something about their senses of humor, and how if you're going into a movie like this thinking you're going to see Ace Ventura, you're going to be disappointed. It's not that movie. It's a different movie altogether, you know?
Yeah, just look at the TV spots and the theatrical preview. That's what the Ace Ventura movies are. It's 90% pratfalls, you know, and you know, goofy voices and stuff. It's what this movie isn't at all, you know? I mean, a limousine pulling up when you think you're in a, you know, in the turn of the century, who knows when it's taking place. Like, that's the kind of comedy this movie has to offer, and it's not an easy sell at all. It's funny because I always equate this film to Freddy Got Fingered, because they're both, you know, huge bombs, critically reviled, and then the person, you know, the director never did another film, and thought, like, well, they must be on some sort of a wavelength with that. But in this interview with in the book with Adam Resnick, he actually says, someday the Freddy Got Fingers of the world will be forgotten, and Cabin Boy will still be around to irritate people. It's like, oh, see, don't even like Freddy Got Fingered. They really are on an island all by themselves, you know, or on definitely, a submarine, definitely. I should say, like in the Great Get a Life episode, Neptune 2000, when they're in the submarine in the bathtub, which is very Cabin Boy-like episode.
Was that a Charlie Kaufman episode? I can't remember if Charlie wrote that one.
Oh, I don't know.
Probably not.
I don't know. It could be.
I know he wrote Zoo Animals on Wheels, but yes, which is a great episode too. Anyway, not to get off on Get a Life. Any final thoughts from you on this movie, and recommendations for folks here?
It's funny because, you know, there are so many comedies that are a communal experience that, you know, you can quote lines with your buddies, and you can, you know, remember the great things about them, and you share it with people of your same mindset. I feel like even though we were throwing lines back and forth at each other, Cabin Boy is a much more intimate experience. You know, it's like a private thing. I don't even know what it is. I don't know if it's just because it fell so far under everyone's radar, that if its unpopularity has anything to do with it, but it just seems like something that, you know, you engage with very personally. And you don't know why, because there are no characters. Oh, what's the great? There's a great Adam line from the commentary that I loved. Oh, he said, what is there to look at in this movie as far as human beings go? I get that, but I think maybe it's that anytime you feel set apart from the human, from regular people, from normal people and normal behavior, this is a movie that like taps into that part of you, you know? So it's like an Ace Ventura or a Biodome. You go and see it and everyone is laughing because there's goofy stuff and it's like established comedy, established bits. And the humor in this movie is like just really reaches in there and grabs part of you that is undefinable, that just feels set apart from everything else. So this is an absolute brilliant movie. I'm so glad it's finally getting its due. I'm glad that they have screenings of it that Chris and Adam can attend and hear people tell them it's a great film. I hope that they're convinced someday. But again, I think the disaster that went into its production, Tim Burton bailing and the struggles that they had making it, and then even the thrashing they took when it came out, all really play into what makes it so unique and kind of made it what it is. So outstanding job. I love this. What do you think of it?
100% agree across the board. And I was just thinking, as much as we may have made it sound like a little bit of a bummer to go through these features, I think if you're a fan of this movie, you owe it to yourself to hear the entire story. And maybe you're not like me, and maybe you already knew a lot of this stuff, but I feel like it's a very rich story that they're telling in terms of all these things. And just, like I said, it's a weird, cathartic thing to hear them tell it, even though I didn't suffer through that. I go through this moment of like, oh man, that's terrible. But now we have this special edition Blu-ray, and now I can't recommend enough that people go and buy this to support the movie. It didn't happen when the movie came out. If you're a fan of the movie and Get a Life and you love Chris Elliott and Adam Resnick, you owe it to yourself to buy this and support the movie now that you can, and it's in this really wonderful edition. Not meant as a guilt trip, but it's just one of those rare instances where you're like, I can give back a little bit. I can support this release of this movie that I love, even though it flopped at the time and I didn't support it then, you know what I mean? Not because, you know, maybe you didn't even know about it, but I just think it's a great disc and will probably be among my favorites of the year, both as the extras are great and I love the movie a lot. So I'm just happy to have it in a nice edition.
Same here, absolutely. And if you're not convinced, I would say if you need a double feature for Captain's Courageous, you couldn't do better.
I think that's great. I'm also going to try Pee-wee's Big Adventure Cabin Boy double feature, which I can't believe I never thought of prior to this. You know, even despite the Tim Burton producing connection, it just never occurred to me. They're not identical by any means, but now suddenly they both are in this weird, fantastic world that's very funny and strange and random. And I love Pee-wee's Big Adventure, and I just was like, wow, I kind of like to see those two movies back to back and see how they play.
It's a good call. I really liked in the commentary where they pointed out that the scene with he and Melora sitting there on the ship is kind of reminiscent of the scene inside the dinosaur head from Pee-wee's.
Very much so.
It's kind of a nice connection that I wouldn't have made on my own.
No, I definitely wouldn't have either. And once they made that connection, suddenly a whole bunch of other things, vague things, just started to line up for me. And I'm like, oh, wow, yeah, these are kind of similar in a certain way. You know, guy goes on adventure. It's weird. You know, obviously Pee-wee's far less annoying than Nathaniel is. But regardless, you know, they're characters that stand out and are not necessarily fully accepted in some of the environments that they put themselves into. Anyway, it's just really a delightful movie and so strange, a cult favorite. And if you watch it, you'll see why. So hopefully you check it out. John, where can people find you online should they wish to do so?
They can find me at thepinksmoke.com, where we have new material every week, and we just started a second podcast that we're going to be doing monthly, which is going to be book-based. We're going to be doing genre books specifically. Chris wants to reclaim the title Pulp Fiction specifically for the kind of things that we're doing, but that's going to be a compliment to the regular Pink Smoke podcasts, where we have, you know, a guest to come on and talk movies. So that's a new venture that we're undertaking. I'm very excited about it. And
very cool.
Yeah. So we're also on Twitter at The Pink Smoke, where you can learn about the site and about us, and go there and find out more about the articles we got coming up and about us and our Patreon account, which we have open.
Well, thank you so much for joining me, John. Greatly appreciated as always. I know we're talking about another show that we're going to do in the near future with a certain... Oh, I don't want to spoil it. But we'll say it's an indicator Blu-ray. We'll go that far and that's it.
Yes, going back to the indicator town. Looking forward to it.
So anyway, that'll be fun. But everybody have a wonderful and Blu-ray filled week. And we'll talk to you soon. Bye-bye.
I go ashore and get my pay. I'll go and meet my S.E. mate. She'll hike her skirt and toss her shoe. She'll clean my pipes, my buddies too. Don't need a church to find my way, 'cause I've found heaven with S.E. mate.
It was the most beautiful thing I've ever heard. It was like honey from the lips of an angel.